That's a replay of a relatively recent show with Eunice and our man, the doctor, who sees a lot of indigenous patients, I guess. My name is Paul Muth. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. And don't ask me what's going on, because I'm ducking and covering, not just the weather report. Watch out for the huge puddles. I've got a couple in my neighborhood where the drains are clogged, apparently. And I got to go venture into the basement and see if anything's seeping. I hope you're not working on your sump pump right now. Sorry I brought it up. Have some coffee and check it out. All right, we're going to go to some Intercepted and some, not Flashpoints, but Monitor out of KPFT in Houston. I guess guy Mark Badawi, that I like a lot, had Colleen Raleigh and Ray McGovern on for his latest episode, and it's quite intriguing. Colleen Raleigh, I'm not going to get to. She was notably a whistleblower of the year, along with three other women, on the cover of Time magazine, and now we have an Orthodox church morphing into the White House, which I don't think Trump's going to visit any Orthodox churches. He's going the trifecta of the Abrahamic religion, supposedly. What a scenario this is. Just to her today, a colleague of Bannon's from Goldman Sachs, an Egyptian-American woman, is getting credit for co-writing the article that Stephen Miller, who's a known Islamophobe, was writing this major address in Saudi Arabia. Whether it's her name on it to make it look good or whether she's supposed to fix some of the atrocities that would just naturally fall off of Stephen Miller's pen, I don't know. I guess we'll see it to believe it. It'll probably be another shocker. That's my opinion. And what you hear here are your opinions of the speakers, not necessarily shared. We have a Malcolm X Remembrance by Glenn Ford, along with a colleague of his, apparently. He's kind of honoring the elders. It would have been Malcolm X's 92nd birthday if he'd gotten on this long. The Intercepted segment is with Glenn Greenwald. He's been pretty busy. I had a segment web exclusive. He was on Democracy Now! This week, very well spoken. He had a little section about the press and about the Barrett Brown case that you probably have never heard of because it wasn't a cause celebre in the U.S. It was internationally known in hacker circles. He got busted for just publishing a link to something somebody else had released, this Stratfor group, one of these many quasi-governmental intelligence outfits. They're privatized intelligence, along with SAIC and the one that Snowden got into after he was in the CIA. Ray McGovern, if you haven't heard me play him before, is an ex-CIA agent. He said he's been 54 years in the D.C. area, coming out of the Bronx originally, I guess. You can still hear that. Pretty intriguing stuff, I think. Pretty iconoclastic. That's why I like Ray McGovern. So we'll be getting to that. You can find it yourself if you're running errands and you only hear a section of it. And I'm not going to play but a section of the Colleen Raleigh unless I can put a sock in it. I've already opinionated myself quite a bit. This is, I've been suggesting that Bannon is probably writing the remarks for the Vatican since he's tied in with the right-wing groups in the Vatican. So he might be trying to putting their points forward to the Pope through Trump, the president. I laugh when I say that. It hurts, though. I've got the latest Public Eye in front of me. Seniors are not for sale. Something about a couple of articles about the Champaign County nursing home, which was pretty much lost vote, but I think they need a supermajority to actually sell the thing or redo it as a so-called cooperative. There's a historical piece from Terry Townsend, who was around at the time, Project 500, and noting in a little box here, SIU Carbondale was earlier, 2 years earlier, in providing higher ed to disadvantaged students, disadvantaged in quotes. They actually started the same year that City University of New York, University of Wisconsin, and University of California, I guess Berkeley, or maybe the whole system in 66. University of Illinois didn't start Project 500 till 1968. There's a little retrospective by local writer Terry Townsend, an activist. Brian Delaner has a piece about this itinerant African-American guy, this homeless guy that I knew tangentially just from knocking around on the sidewalks and the streets. He died of, I would call it a police-induced heart attack, maybe. I don't know what they had said at the coroner's office. It was ruled accidental by somebody. They basically chased him down, and three cops jumped on him, and, whoa, he stopped breathing. A couple articles about co-ops, the Art Theater Co-op, and working co-ops in Illinois. Then there's an article about Green Bay Packers, which is a city-owned franchise of the nonprofit group called the NFL. I have an arrogance about the NFL. I think it's a brutal, stupid game, and it's appropriate to lampoon it. But I guess interesting. I watch high cost soccer, Euro football matches where the Russian oligarchs and Emirate oligarchs and all sorts of people get to play their games. They actually earn more than NFL players on the average. And it's game day today. All right, enough of that. That's my sports report. It's already 7 minutes in, so I better get started. The regular feature, again, though, it isn't just a commentary by Glenn Ford. It's some interviews with a long-standing community foundation guy in Harlem, I guess. I think is where it is, in New York City. Let's see about that. And then Amy Goodman's got a piece that I haven't previewed at all about high crimes and misdemeanors. McGovern is still skeptical about Russian malfeasance in the election, and he actually also mentions that he was at the table next to the table that Flynn was at when they took the picture of Putin sitting down at the table with him like they'd supped together. Apparently, they didn't sup together. Putin did a walk-on and gave an extemporaneous speech and sat down at the table for a few minutes and got a photo op and moved along. So it wasn't like they were caballing at the table. But it's an interesting slice. He's a longtime CIA guy, and he had the Russian desk for quite a while, the Soviet Union desk in those days, a fluent Russian speaker. He's on Radio Sputnik and RT, Russia Today, quite a bit. So go figure. A dissenter writing Samsadat, I guess. All right. I'll probably play the McGovern and the Colleen Raleigh pieces tomorrow in the 5 o'clock hour. But you can find that too through the monitor, wordpress.com.org. Mark Badawi is the interviewer, and I really admire him quite a bit. He has Gareth Porter on quite a bit, who's my Iran expert, and I still haven't finished the book. I'm about to, maybe this afternoon. That's Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. There's one book to read about U.S.-Iranian-Israeli relations. I would recommend that, personally.
Malcolm X would have turned 92 years of age this week if he'd not been cut down by assassins. The event will be marked in many places, including the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Educational and Memorial Center in New York City. Imam Talib Abdul Rashad is a member of the center's advisory board. He says the event is titled, What Malcolm Means to Us.
The legacy of Malcolm X is extremely important because there exists now in the public narrative or in public discourse what I refer to as a homogenized version of Malcolm X that does not present accurately who he was and his impact today. Let me give you one example. Oftentimes today when you hear Al-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, mentioned on television programs, in well-meaning commentary, they will refer to him as, quote, a civil rights leader of the 1960s. But Malcolm X was not a civil rights leader, and he used to make it clear in his speeches and in his interviews that he was not a civil rights leader, but rather a human rights leader. And so this one clarification helps us to understand his impact. Like many great leaders, Malcolm X was a visionary leader. And that is to say that the things that he was doing 50 years ago, the things that he was saying, the direction that he was pointing in with his activist work and his leadership are relevant now. Today's generation, the Black Lives Matter generation, are constantly going to YouTube, viewing Malcolm X videos and speeches, because what he was saying 50 years ago is just as relevant today as it was then.
Yes, and at the Shabazz Center, the events that are held oftentimes have representation from a wide range of demographics, particularly with respect to age. What do you think it is about El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz that allows for the kinds of intergenerational dialogues that often occur up at the Shabazz Center?
He stood on a platform, an uncompromising platform of truth and sincerity and courage, moral courage, and fearlessness. And this is something that appeals to people regardless of their age. And so when we entitle our upcoming celebration, What Malcolm X Means to Us, we felt that that would give an opportunity for a cross-generation of people to speak and to give testimonials. So you'll have elders speaking who were young people when Malcolm X was young, and you will have younger generation leaders who are evolved now who weren't even born when Malcolm was on the scene. And all of them will be able to give personal testimony as to the impact of El-Haj Malik, Malcolm X, on their lives and on their work. I've had the honor several times over the years to MC or to co-MC these programs, and I always ask the audience, how many of you here are here for the first time? And there are always several people who raise their hands. And then I say to them that we hope that this will be your first time, not your last time. So the first thing that we hope people will take away from the event will be a desire to come back for other programs during the year and to look at our educational kiosk to stay tuned in. The second thing is, as I said, this event is to be an inspirational and celebrational event. So we hope that people will walk away from this event inspired, motivated to struggle for freedom, justice, and equality, just as Malcolm X did.
Okay, that was different. No outro. Black Agenda Reports, where you can go find those commentaries, including Kimberly. Oh my gosh, I'm doing a blank on her name. They have an hour program that goes out on WBAI in New York. Conflicted station that it is. And PRN.org, I guess, is, or PRN.FM maybe. It's a progressive news network. I think that still hosts them as well. Well, it's already 15 minutes in, so I'm going to get straight to Amy's commentary. Again, I'll be listening to this for the first time. Didn't have a chance. I guess I scanned the text a little bit. Look for Amy's column on the bottom of the splash page and web exclusives for that Glenn Greenwald segment that I certainly won't have time for. It's only 6 minutes long, but we're going to hear him in conversation with Marcy Wheeler. And I think I bolderized it, so it's ready for airplay. It's a podcast called The Intercepted. And I guess we'll get to that next, and then since I'm talking about it, and then close it out with Ray McGovern and his incorrigible iconoclasm. How about that?
Donald Trump's high crimes and misdemeanors. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump's alleged attempt to quash the FBI investigation into his former national security advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, and his subsequent firing of FBI Director James Comey has rightly inspired endless speculation in the mainstream media about whether he could be impeached. Certainly, the evidence presented by the New York Times, along with everything else that's already consuming Trump's first few months in office, warrants an independent investigation. Perhaps, as with the Watergate scandal that forced President Richard Nixon to resign in disgrace in 1974 to avoid impeachment and removal from office, the cover-up will end up being greater than the crime. But what if Donald Trump were actually held responsible for real crimes, killing civilians in drone strikes, forcing refugees to suffer or die by refusing asylum, or driving the planet headlong into climate change catastrophe? What if Donald Trump keeps his outrageous, inflammatory campaign pledges, many of which, if implemented, would amount to high crimes? Sadly, excessive and too often lethal executive power is now considered normal. Within days of taking office, President Trump, over dinner with his son-in-law Jared Kushner and other associates, approved a SEAL Team 6 raid in Yemen. The raid cost Navy SEAL Ryan Owens his life, as well as the loss of a U.S. military helicopter. But what about the civilian casualties? Despite Trump administration claims that the raid netted extensive intelligence, reports surfaced of at least 30 civilian deaths, including many children. According to Reuters, U.S. military officials said Trump approved his first covert counterterrorism operation without sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup preparations, unquote. This was just one raid in Yemen among thousands in a devastating civil war exacerbated by U.S. arms and support for Saudi Arabia, which is devastating Yemen. Trump is going to Saudi Arabia this week, the first foreign country he'll visit as president. Donald Trump is commander-in-chief, and his casual order over the dinner led to the violent death of tens of innocent people. Is that not a high crime? Jump ahead to mid-April. The U.S. military dropped a bomb on an alleged ISIS target in Afghanistan, which wouldn't garner a line in the news these days, as the longest war in U.S. history drags on into its 17th year with promises by Trump to expand it by sending thousands more troops on the ground. But this was no ordinary bomb. Trump dropped the MOAB, what the Pentagon has nicknamed the mother of all bombs. The GBU-43B Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb is the largest non-nuclear bomb in the world. It's been in the U.S. arsenal since early in the Iraq War, but never used until Commander-in-Chief Donald J. Trump took office. Dr. Hakim is a medical doctor who's provided humanitarian relief in Afghanistan for more than a decade. He reacted to the MOAB's first-ever deployment on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Hakim works with Afghan peace volunteers, an inter-ethnic group of young Afghans dedicated to building nonviolent alternatives to war. Speaking from Kabul, he kept his back turned to the camera, afraid he would suffer retaliation if identified.
I think it's an insult to nickname the bomb the mother of all bombs. This morning, as I was speaking to one of the Afghan peace volunteers, Ali, he said, would any mother do that? Would any mother do that to Mother Earth? Or would any mother do this to any children? The effect is what the U.S. military or what militaries across the world want to inflict upon ordinary citizens, which is fear, panic, hunger, anger.
While the mainstream media have assumed a more oppositional tone since Donald Trump took office, it falls into line when Trump engages in military action. Then the media declare Trump is acting presidential. The same New York Times article that alleged Trump interfered in the Flynn Russia investigation contained another startling revelation. The Times reported, Mr. Comey should consider putting reporters in prison for publishing classified information, according to one of Mr. Comey's associates. A free press is the bedrock of our democratic society. Trump also has promised to expand libel laws to make it easier to go after his critics. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has just appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel to oversee the ongoing investigation of alleged Russian influence over the 2016 U.S. election. Mueller should pursue the facts vigorously and make his findings public. But a complete inquiry into the crimes of Donald Trump must go much further. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
My, oh my. Sorry about that. I hope you could hear that over. I was reliving a memory with Facebook. Richard Galliano, one of my favorites. Maybe somebody's texting me to tell me that I did that. For once I got my headphones on, I didn't notice it was playing in the ambient air. I'm screening Dubious Friends of Donald Trump. It's a documentary, parts one and part two. I've been talking about it. Dubious Friends Zembla, Z-E-M-B-A-L-A. We'll Google it and you'll get to it. It's got the stuff about the Russian connection and to the election, but the slimy, oligarch-ridden financial carapace that is Donald Trump's financial whatever it is. Is excised pretty cleverly, I think, in most of it. I haven't seen part two yet. That's about the diamond trade. This is about the Russian oligarch friends. Maybe there's one that'll chronicle Trump's Saudi connections, too, since some of those princes that seem to just love Baccarat bailed out his some of his casinos, is the way I understand it, some time ago. All right, well, like I said, a lot of stuff, and got about two 20-minute segments and only 38 minutes left. Here's from The Intercepted. I think I left the little skit that usually leads off The Intercepted. They're quite clever, and we need some black humor, I think, in these days. At least I do.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 15 of Intercepted.
I probably, maybe, will confuse people. Maybe I'll expand that, you know, I'll lengthen the time because it should be over with. It should, in my opinion, should have been over with a long time ago because all it is an excuse. But I said to myself, I might even lengthen out the investigation, but I have to do the right thing for the American people.
I think we've come to a point in the Trump presidency where we need to take very seriously the strong possibility that when it comes to the most basic elements of being president, Donald Trump is a bona fide idiot. It truly appears that he's not even trying to figure out how to be president. He's just a failure by almost every possible measure. Now, I'm not saying that there is no possibility that there are dark secrets in need of exposing about Donald Trump. I mean, certainly there are. His financial dealings remain totally shrouded in secrecy. The firing of the FBI director, James Comey, is undoubtedly an ominous development. You have senior members of Trump's campaign team and some that are still in his administration that have a lot to answer for, particularly when it comes to their dealings with various Russian officials. Now, maybe there is some lurid or scandalous truth about Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin that will one day be revealed. Maybe. But what we know, because it's sitting there in plain sight in front of all of us, is that this guy is not in control. Or rather, he is in control, and it's a complete and total train wreck. He doesn't read his intelligence briefings. He needs the world explained to him with basically cartoons that have to fit on one page or he's going to lose attention. He seems to genuinely not understand how government works or what the Constitution actually says. Donald Trump's behavior around world leaders is buffoonish and it's embarrassing. So by all means, let's have aggressive investigations of Trump from all angles. But it's long past due that we recognize the obvious, that when it comes to just basic issues of competency, Trump is a clown. The latest scandal revolves around this bizarre meeting that Trump had with Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, and Moscow's ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. Trump had that meeting the day after he fired FBI Director Comey. Now, just on a basic level, the timing of that meeting was unforgivably dumb. Just on the level of optics, on the most basic level. But then Trump bars the U.S. press from coming into that meeting, even to take the little pictures at the beginning of it. But he does allow in a Russian photographer. And it's because of the pictures that the Russian photographer released that we even knew that Ambassador Kislyak was in the meeting. Trump was not going to tell us that. His administration was not going to release that fact. And Kislyak is one of the main figures at the center of this whole Russia affair. Now, maybe this was a nefarious, super secret meeting where Trump was going to spill state secrets to the Russians because they have him compromised. They have the P tape. He has secret financial dealings in Russia. Maybe. But set all of that aside for a second and consider the obvious. Trump is arrogant. Trump likes to brag. And Trump has proven to be a buffoon as president of the United States. The man has diarrhea of the brain. Whatever pops into his head is going to come shooting out of his mouth. Or he's going to just tweet it. What's way more likely than Trump intentionally divulging anything classified to the Russians because he's compromised or actively working with Moscow to undermine the United States is that he is as he seems. He's the village idiot who somehow ended up as president. And this is not actually a funny situation. In fact, it's a quite dangerous situation, given the views, the publicly espoused views of Trump and his team on a wide range of foreign and domestic issues, their view of poor people, their view of immigrants, both documented and undocumented, their views of Islam and Muslims, their views of foreign policy, their views of healthcare. What we already know and can prove is frightening enough. And I'm far more worried about the damage they can do with whatever time they have in the White House than I am about what the Russians are going to do. When the story of Trump divulging sensitive information to the Russians in the Oval Office broke, the White House response was, in typical Trump administration fashion, a complete shit show of contradictions, denials, and then next day tweets that make everyone in this country wonder what the hell we're witnessing. To try to make even a shred of sense of this, I'm joined by two people, Marcy Wheeler, who runs the excellent website emptywheel.net, and Glenn Greenwald, who is my fellow co-founder of The Intercept. Marcy, Glenn, welcome back to Intercepted.
Thank you for having me.
Great to be back.
So, Marcy, let's begin with you. What is your analysis of the most recent sort of scandal, what have you, that we're hearing now about Trump?
Three things. I mean, one, yet again, he's running his mouth. He is, according to the people leaking this, doing highly inappropriate things. And again, it involves Russians. Big surprise. Second thing is, frankly, maybe we'll get to the bottom of what this laptop threat is that has DHS threatening to take our laptops away from us and putting them down under the plane where they can search them until we get them back at baggage claim, because it seems like another one of those threats emanating from the Middle East where we all run around going, ah, and no one wants to talk about it. So maybe this will lead to some illumination on that. And then the third thing, the key about that story is they're like, oh my gosh, Trump told Kislyak and Lavrov what city this threat emanated from, what city it came from. And that's the horrible thing. Because
in ISIS-controlled territory.
In ISIS-controlled territory. And there's only, what, like three cities left that they control. So, you know, process of elimination. But it was about sharing the city, because the ally that shared that information with us will be horrified to learn that he shared that city. And if you look at the original Washington Post story on it, they make it clear that the sources leaking to them shared the city. And then they went and made a story out of the fact that both Trump shared the city and these U.S. officials, which, of course, you know, could mean anything, then shared the city with the Washington Post. And it's like, you know, let's go beat up Trump. I'm really happy to do that. But at the same time, let's also be aware of the fact that the leakers behind this story did precisely what they're accusing Trump of. And as the Washington Post makes clear, for them, it's illegal.
Now, the New York Times is reporting that, and they're basing this on a current and a former American official familiar with how the United States obtained the information. New York Times saying that the classified intelligence that Trump supposedly disclosed in this meeting with the Russians was intelligence provided by Israel. Is there any significance to that in your view?
It would have been one of the obvious choices. I'm a little bit less worried that Israel's really going to stop sharing intelligence with the United States. I mean, come on, right? But it also might explain the leaks from all of these people to journalists in the United States, feeling like it was cool to leak the same information, the city, whereas it wasn't cool for Trump to leak intelligence to the Russians. That, you know, you could explain that. And there's also the focus on, well, maybe Iran will get that. Makes a lot more sense if this is Israel.
You know, for all of the kind of hooting and hollering about Trump giving classified information to the Russians, when you actually look at the details as they're reported right now, I wouldn't say that it's a nothing burger, but it does seem like the reaction is disproportionate to what we understand Trump actually said or so, you know, supposedly revealed to the Russians. What do you make of the timing of this leak, given that this meeting happened a day after James Comey was fired as FBI director?
Yeah, it makes it look a lot more like retaliation for the Comey firing, particularly given what the week between the meeting to when it was dropped on all these newspapers. And maybe that's just explained by the fact that the IC had to go brief U.S. officials in Congress who then ran to the press to leak it. But the other thing to explain the timing, I think, is this will make it harder to do what Trump seems intent on doing this week, which is naming an FBI director candidate before Comey actually testifies. So it's really hard to separate those two things. It does seem like retaliation. The response, the way in which this orchestrated six different outlets reporting the story in quick succession, definitely seems like a response to the Comey firing.
Well, and if it was a hit, it's a pretty successful hit, assisted, no doubt, by Trump's total and complete incompetence.
Yeah, he's an idiot. I mean, there's no question he did something inappropriate, and there is no question that he doesn't even know what he did because he's an idiot. He doesn't know how to deal with this information. Doesn't excuse that he did it. It, you know, that's part of the reason why he's problematic. But he sort of fell into their not trap, because you don't need a trap to capture Trump, but it just seems all neat.
Glenn, what is your initial analysis of what's happening here? Because you were tweeting about this and looking at Trump's tweets about Edward Snowden and saying, when is that human piece of garbage going to be returned to the United States, and that he was leaking America's secrets. But your initial take on this?
Right. So obviously Trump did something reckless and impetuous and a byproduct of his complete ignorance. And that's obviously not a surprise to anyone. And there's hypocrisy involved, given what you just referenced. But there's several things bothering me. Number one is that we don't actually know what it is that he revealed, and therefore can't really assess how serious or damaging it actually is. You could imagine plausible examples of things he might have said that were classified, but that I can't understand why it would be so damaging, such as we learn that ISIS in a particular city is planning on taking down planes using laptops, something that was already publicly known, even if the details of it weren't. Secondly, it continues to really bother me, and so it makes me very wary that so many of our stories are shaped by anonymous intelligence sources whose word is just taken as gold, even though no evidence is offered, even though they have all kinds of axes to grind. Story after story involves people in the intelligence community running to the Washington Post or CNN in order to disclose stories that are harmful to Trump that we don't really know any corroboration for. And then thirdly, and I think the thing bothering me most, is that we continue to accept this premise that the U.S. and Russia are intractable, overarching enemies, almost like it's the worst part of the Cold War, when the reality is, as Obama himself continually acknowledged, the U.S. and Russia have a lot of common interests, especially in the counterterrorism realm, and especially when it comes to fighting ISIS. I mean, ISIS actually probably took down a Russian plane in retaliation for Russian bombing in Syria. It makes sense that the two countries would want to cooperate when it comes to sharing intelligence about ISIS threats. So it's not like he's sharing information in a realm where they actually have adverse interest or where we're truly enemies. It seems to be a very dumb and poorly thought through decision, but one that I don't think we have any evidence to believe is really so cataclysmic.
Marcy, in the immediate aftermath of this story initially breaking in the Washington Post and then all of these other media outlets then, you know, say that they confirmed various elements of it, particularly the core element, you had Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's statement released by the White House, not the State Department. And then you had the National Security Advisor McMaster come out onto the lawn at the White House.
The story that came out tonight, as reported, is false. The president and the foreign minister reviewed a range of common threats to our two countries, including threats to civil aviation. At no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed.
There was a lot of parsing of his words in the news coverage of this, saying, you know, he said no sources or methods were revealed, but that's not what the reporting on this said. But in fact, McMaster said the story as reported is totally false. What's going on there?
You know, it's not clear that revealing the city would be a source and method. Presumably it wouldn't, because I didn't realize CNN got it too, but CNN, Washington Post, and how many of the other 15 journalists who have gotten this story dumped onto their lap have been told the city, right? Somewhere between the White House version and the version of the sources all leaking this, there's a lot of flux about whether Trump shared information that would make it obvious to the Russians what the real story is. And I think that's a really interesting question, because we are making a great big deal out of this. And there's enough flux in the story, right? And this whole thing, oh, it's about the city. That's not a source of method. Let's name the three cities it could be, right? That's not that hard to do.
Glenn, I wanted to get your response to something that Alan Dershowitz said on CNN about this story.
This is the most serious charge ever made against a sitting president of the United States. Let's not underestimate it.
Your response?
I mean, that's nothing more than an obvious joke. You know, it's possible that what Trump did here, if you use your very active imagination, could fulfill that description if he purposely gave the names of spies inside Moscow to Russia in order for the Russians to apprehend and then kill them. That would actually be treason. But there's zero evidence this was anything like that. No one thinks that. So you have presidents who have launched secret wars and killed millions of people, implemented worldwide torture regimes, engaged in genocide, and interred American citizens with no due process for years. The list of extreme presidential crimes goes on and on and on and on. To call this most serious accusation ever made against a sitting president is an inherent joke. And I think the kind of hysteria that constantly is now acceptable whenever the topic is Trump and Russia.
And Marcy, you know, we also know that McMaster said the day after this story came out
that the president wasn't even aware, you know, of where this information came from. He wasn't briefed on the source or method of the information either.
I want to sort of fly up to 30,000 feet here and ask you about the overall unfolding or unraveling of the Trump presidency. What is really going to bring all of this to a head? Because my sense is that Trump's own conduct since he became president is far more of a threat to his presidency than anything that they're going to uncover about him or that we have any sense they're going to uncover about him related to Russia. I mean, barring some P tape or, you know, some violation of the emoluments clause of the Constitution, isn't it the case that Trump has basically created his own scandal that could lead to his downfall?
I mean, I would separate the Comey scandal from this scandal. And I would caution people that I'd be happy to see the rear end of Trump as much as anybody, but there are many ways he can be brought down. One is the way the intelligence community would like to, which is this leak. The other one is an extreme abuse of power with the Comey firing, which, you know, I sort of regard this leak campaign as a response to that. But the other is that he's unfit, that he has all of these compromises. His son, Jared Kushner, I think, has even bigger compromises. He kept Mike Flynn when it was clear he shouldn't be around. And so it's worthwhile for people to keep those different strands in mind and think very seriously about what they want to be the undoing of a president and whether they want the IC to set the terms for that or whether they want gross corruption to set the terms for that.
It seems to me as though the Democrats and a lot of media figures have really latched on to any part of this that has the word Russia and Trump in it, and they go to town, even if there really isn't evidence to back up the allegations. And my concern is that the actual truth is far less less salacious or incendiary than the allegations. Is there any long-term consequence to the way the Trump investigations are unfolding and being talked about in the broader culture of U.S. media?
Yeah, I mean, there's supposed to be legal and constitutional means for removing a president under certain prescribed circumstances. And I think what people are finding is that at least as of yet, they can't demonstrate that Trump falls within the scope of that, but nonetheless believe that he's such a threat to democratic institutions or the stability of the United States that anything and everything is justified in order to remove him, in order to take him down. And that's ultimately going to become, I think, a critical question is it more damaging to leave Trump in office? Or is it more damaging until those constitutional or legal standards can be fulfilled? Or is it more damaging to just say, let's have the media and the intelligence community, the deep state, as it were, work together to just destroy him, even though he won the election, because they believe that leaving him in office is more damaging than whatever the long-term damages are from them kind of going outside the rules to remove a president who won? And I think that's the dilemma that we face. And that's a really serious question, no matter how much you hate Trump. And I don't think there's an easy answer to it.
Marcy, 10 seconds. Does Trump finish one term as president of the United States?
I doubt it.
Most likely way that he goes?
I have no idea. I mean, I think he's not having any fun either. And he is increasingly not competent to do the job. So there's always the 25th Amendment. I think the big question is whether his approval ratings among Republicans stand, because I think as soon as those start to fall apart, that's when the Republicans will move.
Dr. Marcy Wheeler, thank you very much for being with us on Intercepted.
Awesome to be here.
Glenn, thank you very much for joining us as well.
It's always an honor.
Marcy Wheeler at emptywheel.net, I believe, up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, with that homespun metaphor about wanting to see the back end of Trump, I'd say. The rump of Trump. Sorry, I had to go there. I couldn't help myself. Yeah, Zembla, the dubious friends of Donald Trump. I haven't watched the Diamond King episode yet, but there's a lot of slime there. And maybe there'll be a Saudi one, too. Well, I said I was going to play most of Ray McGovern today, so I think I'm going to do that right now again. You'll find it iconoclastic. It also just pretty much dismisses the Russian involvement in the election. There's a lot of stuff going on around now in alternative press stuff about Seth Rich, the guy that was mysteriously found dead, shot in the back twice, three times with all of his jewelry and watch and credit cards and cash valued about $2,000 on him. And he had been a DNC operative, and there are now people saying that they found emails in his computer between one of the representatives of WikiLeaks, who unhappily is also dead, but he was an older guy by natural causes, apparently, so don't let your one's tendency to conspiratorial. But it is a good question, and Ray McGovern has penned on it in a couple of places and opined on it. But anyway, 20 minutes into 15, I hope I'll get most of his funny anecdotes on. Thanks for listening. And this is from Monitor out of KPFT in Houston, not the usual left coast
Ray McGovern.
Producers.
He's a longtime guest and friend of the show. He spent 27 years in the CIA as an analyst. His career there spanned administrations from JFK to George H.W. Bush. He leads currently the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the Word, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, D.C. And just to give you a brief bit of background for his CIA career, it included chairing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief. During 81 to 85, he briefed one-on-one President Ronald Reagan and five of the most senior national security advisors. He's been on the show multiple times. Hopefully you already know who he is. Ray, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
We just had Colleen Rowley on, and we talked about the sort of view of the removal of James Comey from an FBI perspective, from the sort of national inside the U.S. intelligence perspective, and how a lot of this is being politicized. We touched very briefly on some of the allegations about Russia, but I'm saving that for you. You spent all those years in the CIA, and you obviously have continued to follow this issue very closely. And I'm going to give you a similar question to something that I asked Colleen, and that is, for the average person out there trying to make sense of all of this and having basically only the media to rely on, it can be a bit confusing, to say the least, to understand what is allegation, what is spin, what is partisan hackery, for want of a better term, and what is, at this point, provable intelligence fact. So let's try and unpick this a little bit. What do we know about the allegations that are made about Russia, and what do we know as provable at this point?
Well, Mark, you do quite right to say that the American people are confused, but I would take it a step further and say that they are being deliberately misled. The evidence, so-called, for Russian hacking or Russian interference in the U.S. election last year is non-existent, except if you look at the New York Times and the Washington Post, which each newspaper has this sort of campaign to show that the Russians are behind every evil. And what speaks most to the American people, of course, is the Russians are behind the fact that we have Trump for president. Now, if you want to think of something to blame a nation with, that's about that's about as worse as bad as you can get, right? And of course, you have the Democrats. It's really bizarre. The Democrats are on this rampage to show that the Russians gave the election to Trump. Why? Well, two reasons really. Because it could not be, it simply could not be, that Hillary Clinton was a fatally flawed candidate whom no one trusted and ran a terrible campaign. That couldn't be it. No. It's got to be something else. And the something else originated 2 days before the Democratic National Convention, when all of a sudden emails showed up, concrete, substantive, original emails that were gotten from the Democratic National Committee and from Hillary, and what they showed was pure and simple that Hillary stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders. Witness the fact that within one day, Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her four chief lieutenants quit. Now, this is really serious stuff. How are they to know how Bernie would react to this? That was the content of the emails. So they sat around a table 2 days before the convention. I'm like, my God, what are we going to do? And somebody said, I know, we'll blame it on the Russians. And someone else said, well, wait a second. It wasn't the Russians. It was WikiLeaks. It was Julian Assange. No problem. We'll say that Assange is working for the Russians. But what would the rationale be? Oh, come on. The Russians clearly want Trump to win. Now, if you look at that as a kind of a syllogism, Mark, you know, a major premise, the Russians really want Trump to win. Well, my God. You know, the choice in November was what the Germans call eine Wahlzwischen Pest und Cholera, a choice between plague and cholera. Okay. Now, I am, you know, I would be shocked if Putin looked at our election process with any distinct preference for who might win. Here's a guy, I could see him around the table with his Kremlin advisor saying, man, this guy Trump, wow. You know, he's not only unpredictable, he brags about it. He says this is a great advantage to be unpredictable. And my God, he lashes out at the slightest slight or offense, whether real or imagined. And then I see Putin saying, this is just the guy, just the right guy that I want to have his fingers on the nuclear buttons. You know, it doesn't parse. I can't conceive of Putin having any preference for Trump. And if you don't accept the major premise, what happens to the rest of it? It disappears. More particular, there is no evidence. There is no evidence at all that the Russians hacked or that the Russians tried to influence the election one way or another. And, you know, if you look for logic, well, didn't we all sort of assume that Hillary's going to win? Now, does anyone think that Vladimir Putin was clairvoyant? They said, no, guys, watch this. Donald Trump's going to win, so I'm going to help him. No way would that happen. In other words, if I were Putin and I saw that Hillary was definitely going to win, the last thing I would want to do is hack into the DNC and her emails and cause cause célèbre for her to lash out at Russia as soon as she wins. So none of it makes any sense. Why did they do this? Well, they did this to distract. They did this to distract attention from what? From the content of these original emails that Julian Assange released 2 days before the convention. And what did they do? They blamed it on Russia. They blamed it on Russia. And guess what? It worked like a charm. Because the mainstream media, as you will recall, in Times, the Post, the Wall Street Journal, they all said, why? Who did this? Who did this hack? Was it the Russians? Looks like it was the Russians. And nobody paid any attention, not even Bernie Sanders, to the fact that the emails were a terribly damning thing, indicating that there was no fair play in the DNC and that Bernie Sanders would have won hand down were he allowed to compete fairly. Then worse still, Bernie Sanders would be our president now if it weren't for this this mess. And so the Russian thing had a life of its own. Hillary Clinton's PR person, Jennifer Palmieri, she bragged in an article she wrote for the Outlook section of the Washington Post 2 months ago. She bragged about how she went around in a golf cart to all the media tents at the convention and tried to persuade them that the Russians were responsible for that hack. And she says, you know, they weren't able to understand that. It was too much of a stretch. And she says, you know, it's a bit of a stretch for me. But then they got back to Brooklyn, and guess what? The intelligence people briefed us. This is Palmieri. Intelligence people showed us, and they shared with us. And so then we had lots to use, but the Americans weren't sufficiently scared, but we used it. And now, of course, with the election lost, the same cudgel is being used, not only to explain why Hillary lost, but to put the kibosh on Trump's efforts to work out a decent relationship with Russia. That's the real problem.
And now, Ray, I think, you know, so people who don't know you or don't know your politics might think that you are now or at some point were at least a supporter of Donald Trump, and that you like the man, you like his politics, and that you're just making excuses for him. What is the truth behind that allegation?
You know, thanks for pointing it out. You know, we have this thing, we intelligence officers. We think the truth is important, and even if it redounds to the benefit of one or another policymaker or politician, I think the truth really does set us free. Now, I detest Donald Trump and all he stands for. I think his internal policies, his domestic policy, are unconscionable. Same for most of his foreign policies. The only saving grace The only thing that I felt relatively optimistic about was his very sensible dictum that it made sense to work out a less tense relationship with the sole country that can obliterate us and the rest of the world if we push it too far. Now, the outcome of all this falderal is that Trump has been made into a Putin puppet. And the danger in that, of course, is that when he gets the slightest chance, as he did when there was this chemical event in Idlib province in Syria, to show that he's no puppet of Putin, well, how many Tomahawk missiles are about to expire at the end of the month?
Right.
59, sir. Oh, let's shoot him out into Syria. I'll show him. And guess what? It worked like a charm. The mainstream media all of a sudden gave Trump very high marks for being decisive.
So, and for being presidential.
Yeah, and for shooting these beautiful, beautiful cruise missiles. I mean, God, you know, I've never seen it so bad, Mark. And I've been around here 54 years, count them, 54 years in Washington. I've been saying for 10 years that I've seen lots of change in those 54 years, but that there's one change that dwarfs all the others in significance, and that is that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free press. That is big. That is about the biggest change that you could imagine. And the events of the past couple of months prove that in spades, in my view.
So let me shift gears a little bit and ask you to respond to a timeline of events that I've seen a lot of people speculate about, and they've been trying to fill in the blanks or the gaps to understand things. My own take, for full disclosure, is I don't actually believe that there was any Russian interference in the election really at all. But I am willing to believe that there is significant amount of collusion and corruption among people in circles of power. Their interests intersect fairly frequently, and whenever there's money to be made, for example, they'll quite happily go and make it, regardless of what their claimed public ideology might be. And that's kind of my default position. I expect people in positions of power to succumb to corruption from time to time. So, with that said, we've got a series of events from, you know, middle of January until the resignation of Michael Flynn that make people wonder what on earth is happening, and I don't think they really understand it, and I'm curious to get your take. So, we've got Donald Trump inaugurated on January 20th. Within a week, then, we've got Yates and McGahn and Flynn in this circle of Flynn is potentially compromised, and then Trump having dinner with James Comey and asking him for some sort of loyalty oath. Within a day of that, on the 28th, Trump and Putin speak for an hour, and Michael Flynn is in the office during the phone call. And 2 days after that, Trump fires Yates. 3 days after that, the White House gets the intelligence on Flynn, supposedly. And then a week after that, the Washington Post publishes the scoop on Flynn, who then 4 days later resigns. So what's your take on the whole Putin, Trump, Comey, Flynn situation, and what do you make of it, given your years of experience? What do you think is or was going on there?
In 90 seconds, please.
Well, I know Flynn. I was in Moscow when he was there in December of 2015. Same place, same invitation. The only difference was I didn't get paid for what I said. I was allowed to speak for as long as I wanted, and I did, before a very large audience that was carried live on RT. Now, Flynn went there, and, they didn't offer me any money. Let's make that clear. But when they offered Flynn money, he's not the smartest guy in the world. He probably should have turned that down. What did they pay him? I think they paid him $33,000. Now, that's just terrible, isn't it? When you look at what Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and, more recently, Barack Obama.
Yeah, 400,000, right?
400 grand for a speech at Walter. Give me a break. So these people are venal, okay? But, Trump accepting 33 grand, I don't think that, that's not even the same ballpark.
He meant to say Flynn. Flynn, again... Ray McGovern, and sorry to cut that off, but I didn't time it out very well. Mark Badawi is the producer. He has the website, and it's a pretty prominent Saudi name, Badawi. He's an Arab American in Houston. Monitor at the monitor at WordPress.com gets you there too, I think. You can hear the rest of it. I'm going to play the entirety of that tomorrow. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared at the station. A lot of dissension is possible. It's a good thing, we think, perhaps, maybe. Did I say WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio? Let's do a little community under.